Welcome back to Writers' Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host, my guest co-host, Paul Gandy, local attorney specializing in issues of consumer bankruptcy debt. And before we took that little break to fix some technical difficulties, Mr. Gandy was explaining how Dr. Batra came to our attention, to his attention. And did you were you finished with that explanation, or
just
did I
a couple
interrupt
of points? Just a couple of points. So on our listserv, consumer bankruptcy listserv, Dr. Batra's name was mentioned several times, and many attorneys referred to his articles, his comments, his interviews, and I had the opportunity to read one or two of those comments and the articles, and I thought that here's a professional, here's an academic who's been very present, I guess that's the word we would say, very forward-thinking and almost eerily accurate in predicting the current situation we find ourselves in. Almost frighteningly so, but there is a, luckily, I think you'll find there is a silver lining. But I thought it would be very interesting if he had the time to speak with us about his latest work and about his theories.
Dr. Batra, how does it feel to be right about something so terrible?
Well, actually, I'm very sad because I've been writing books trying to warn the public and the government for a very long time, and in the process I put my whole career on the line, and a lot of people disagreed with me, in fact ridiculed my thought and so on, but I was hoping that we could introduce economic reforms in time and that would prevent it all, but quite often, you know, they say prevention is better than cure, but I guess we don't we pay attention until the sickness hits us. So that's the case right now. So I don't think I'm very happy to see what's happening.
Dr. Batra is an accomplished... Dr. Batra is a published author. He published, let me see, Dr., 7 or 8, maybe 10 or 12, I'm sorry, books. And the one we're talking about today is titled The New Golden Age: The Coming Revolution Against Political Corruption and Economic Chaos. Dr. Batra, am I correct? You're currently a professor of economics at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas?
Yes.
Could you give us a little bit of, tell us a little bit about your background, your academic background, how you came to be teaching at SMU in Dallas?
Well, I did my master's in economics in India at the Delhi School of Economics. That's where I got a lot of good grounding in economics. Came here into the United States, did my PhD, and for 2 years I went to Canada and taught at University of Western Ontario. Canada was so cold, and in the month of January, SMU had invited me to come give a seminar. And I had left freezing in behind, and here I come, it was 64 degrees. They made me an offer and I immediately accepted. I said, this is like New Delhi to me, I'm coming here. So that's how I ended up at SMU, and that's where I've been for the past 30 years.
I can understand what I can understand that. It gets pretty cold up here too.
Let me read you from the back jacket of his book. And that book was published in 2007, is that correct, Doctor?
Yeah, it was published, I think the pub date was in January 2007, but it went into press at the end of 2006. So by that time, it was out of my hand.
So most of the research you had completed for this book was done in the year by the year 2006.
Right. We could say by the maximum, latest by October, November, latest by October, I think.
The reason I'm asking the doctor this question is you're going to see in listening to this conversation, hopefully, how very forward-thinking, how very accurate he has been in predicting the very economic malaise we find ourselves in today. But the back flap of this book has a praise for the book written by Dr. Curtis Priest, who's a director of Center for Information Technology and Society at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. We know as a world-renowned school of technology. And he states in his description, Dr. Batra vividly portrays in the book now the way in which public disgust for corruption, both federal, corporate, and federal, is becoming a serious force for political change. Batra recognizes that the increasing opposition, oppression from debt, oppression of our armies, and a gigantic divide between our haves and have-nots is bringing huge risks to our economy and standard of living. Batra brings the oil pricing scandal into full view, noting that prices have risen by financial speculation, not by lack of supply. Increasing rage among middle Americans demands that we leave Iraq and move from the materialistic acquisitioning mode of our culture to a golden age where civility is prized above greed. Would you say, Doctor, that Dr. Priest, in those few words, sums up accurately the direction of your book, the focus of your book, the message of your book?
Yes, it sums it up quite vividly, and some of the details are of course different, but it's a very good, very accurate description of my book.
Well, let's get right into the book. I mean, here's the acknowledgement, and here's a statement you make, if I may. You say, the poor are, your research indicates, the poor are about to multiply all over the globe, so much so that the oppressed masses will revolt and overthrow the ruling elite, culminating in a planetary golden age in which poverty will become a thing of the past. Like many abuses discarded in the dustbin of human history, hunger and deprivation would simply vanish. That's very encouraging, but in reading your book, to get there, we've got some things to go through that may not be so pleasant.
Well, that's right. That's why, remember, the subtitle is that the coming revolution against political corruption and economic chaos. So the subtitle contains this economic chaos part, and that chaos is right here. Right now it's here, and unfortunately, it will go on for 2 or 3 more years, unless we introduce reforms right away. So the point is that while it's a part of the cycle to have this chaos, we also have the ability to shape events with our own actions, and that's what we need to do, and that's the emphasis of the book, that nothing is engraved in sand, nothing is just given to us. Our actions are very important, our choices are very important. And we can fix it. I think we can fix it in about 12 months, 18 months at the most. It can be fixed very quickly.
So it's not too late to change direction.
No, but the thing is, they are making things worse. I wrote an article on the bailout about a month ago when the legislation was being considered. That article is on my website, by the way. RaviBatra.com, one word, RaviBatra.com. The article is there, and in that article I explained why this bailout was unnecessary and a horrendous piece of legislation. We were wasting money at a time when the budget deficit is extremely high, and the assumption is that we can borrow as much money from the rest of the world and nothing, there will be no consequences to this. It reminds me of the assumption that Greenspan made that the country, that the public could borrow a lot of money from banks and the banks could be reckless in lending their money and nothing would happen. This is, now we are assuming that we can borrow as much money as we want from the rest of the world and everything will be fine. No, it's not true. Debts come back to haunt us. So this bailout was a really bad piece of legislation. And we are giving these bailouts, more and more of these. Those have to be avoided. But there is a simple way, very commonsensical way to fix the economy, and that's what we should be doing.
Aren't these bailouts attempts to save our system of economics?
Well, that's what the name they give to legislation. They give very catchy and nice sounding names. The purpose of this bailout, as they said it, was to unfreeze credit from the banking system. The banks are not lending money, and so they wanted to unfreeze this credit from the banking system so people could borrow money again for their homes and for their cars and so on, and the economy could get moving again. That was the stated purpose of that legislation. But in the process, what are they doing? What they are doing is this. They are not only going to help the banks, they're also going to help Wall Street, which created the problem to begin with. They're going to help companies like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, and these companies are borrowers. They are not the lenders. They're not banks. They borrow money and speculate with that money. In the process, they raise our oil prices sharply, and the big jump in the oil price is a major reason why we are in the soup right now. So in the name of unfreezing the credit markets, in the name of helping the banks, they are also wasting money on those, on the culprits that created the problem. So that's what I'm saying. It's wastage. It's not a good use of our tax dollars. And as far as helping the banks is concerned, we did not need separate legislation for that. The FDIC is already there to help the banks. And if the FDIC needed more money, the Congress could have easily given them the money in a straightforward way. But this was just a way so that Hank Paulson, the former CEO of Goldman Sachs, could simply help his buddies out. That was the main. I see that as the main reason for this legislation.
Doctor, could you mentioned and you focus a great deal in your book on a theory of the law of what you call social cycles. Could you take what you just said, perhaps, and put that in the context, maybe explaining a bit more what the law of social cycles means?
Well, the law of social cycles was first offered by my late teacher in India. His name is P.R. Sarkar. He is the original author of the law. I extended it further to see if that law was valid in the context of various civilizations. And to my big surprise, I found that this law of social cycles explains the movement, the evolution of society everywhere in the world. And the law is actually very simple. It says that in every society, there are three main sources of political power. To repeat, political power can be obtained in three main ways. One way is what we know today, that is with the help of money. Money brings you political power. That's one way. The other way is when you control ideas, people become powerful when they have control over ideas. That was the way of the church in the past. The priesthood controlled ideas in the past, and that's how they came to power. And there is a third way, and that is with the help of the military might, the military superiority. If you have a strong military, then you can dominate a country or society and essentially snatch political power in your hand. So these are the only three ways to gain political power and social supremacy: physical strength, or the control over ideas, or the power of money. These are the only three ways in which people become politically powerful. So the law of social cycles says that in every society, first there was rule of the military class or the warrior mind. The military class has a certain mentality. It's called the warrior mind. So first there was the rule of the military class. Then it was that rule was followed by the rule of intellectuals like priests or various other writers and so on. The rule of intellectuals was eventually followed by the rule of the wealthy, which I call the acquisitive class, people who just want to acquire more and more money, and even if they don't need it, they just want more and more money. That's the acquisitive class. So this is the social cycle. First the rule of warriors, then come the rule of intellectuals, then the rule of acquisitors.
And you've decided...
Age of acquisitors... Hello?
I'm sorry. I don't want to interrupt you, but except to say that you've, in your book, you've analyzed the United States and come to a conclusion as to which part of the cycle we find ourselves in.
Right. The United States, from the very beginning of the Republic, has been in the age of acquisitors, in the age of the wealthy. And now it so happens that in every age of acquisitors, there is a lot of materialism in society, and other values are forgotten, especially towards the end of that age. And when those other values are forgotten, you have a lot of crime, pornography, and the final result is a lot of poverty.
And
people
get
so fed up, then they overthrow the acquisitive rule in a revolution.
One of the, if I understand you correctly, Professor, one of the signs that the acquisitive cycle is coming to an end or reaching a point of tumult is where the acquisitors, the wealthy, the wealth becomes concentrated into fewer and fewer hands, and as I believe you describe in your book, the wage gap continues to expand. Now, I think in your book you talked about, or you mentioned the year 1973 as a pivotal year in this cycle in this country. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Right. See, until, according to my calculations, until 1973, we were in the age of acquisitors. And then after that year, that was a year when Nixon was, I think, thrown out. He resigned because of the Watergate scandal.
Right. You talk about the wage gap beginning to expand at that point.
And that year is also so happens that that year is also when the wage gap began to rise. Now, this wage gap is very important in the smooth functioning of any economy. Look at any country in the world. Any country in the world, the economic problems they have come from the rising wage gap. What is this wage gap? Well, the wage gap is the difference between a worker's productivity and the salary he or she gets. So that's the wage gap. The difference between productivity and wages is the wage gap.
And you make the point in your book that what has happened in this society is over time, more and more of the wealth, more and more of the wealth is being concentrated in fewer and fewer hands, so that such the case that in our country, CEOs, as a percentage of their income compared to the income of the typical line worker in a company, is many times more in this country, many times more when you compare the two, than in other industrialized nations. So the CEOs, the executives, the investment bankers at the top are making a lot more money, but the people who work for them or in the companies are comparatively making less and less money.
Well, that shows that the CEO is the real ruler of society. The CEO of the big Fortune 500 companies really rule this country. Nobody can really challenge them. And so, problem that we have today, and that's why we have so much poverty. All the policies that the government adopts and follows are run in the interest of the CEO. Whether it helps the country or hurts the country, they don't care. This is what has been happening for the past, since 1980, when Reagan took over. Although the wage gap started to rise in 1973, until 1980, its bad effects were not fully, were not very clear until that year, because in 1981 or so, Reagan adopted economic policies that actually worsened the effects of the rising wage gap, that contributed to the bad effects that follow from the rising wage gap. And let me explain. It's very simple to see why this inequality or wealth concentration or the rising wage gap are extremely harmful.
Didn't during that presidential administration our deficit exploded? During the Reagan administration, didn't it grow?
But see, people think the deficit exploded from out of some vacuum. It exploded for a reason. They had to raise the budget deficit and create a lot of government debt to contain the ill effects that follow from the rising wage gap.
So it
was done to make sure that the economy stabilizes, even though workers' wages actually go down. The real wage actually goes down. So That's the reason why not only the federal government started creating this deficit, even Greenspan and our monetary policy became such that we want the consumer to borrow a lot of money to keep the economy sound. Why did we need all that? The reason is the rising wage gap.
And this is a sign, if I'm understanding correctly what you write in your book, of the downside, the decline, or the bringing to the conclusion of the time when the inquisitor class dominates.
That's right. This is what happens this is what happens towards the end of the age of inquisitors. The wage gap rises so much so much concentration of wealth and poverty that people see no other way except to put an end to the rule of money in politics. Now, if you look at the 1920s, in that decade also the wage gap went up sharply. And there was then a stock market bubble, which was followed by a crash. But still, the wage gap did not rise enough for the revolution to occur. The wage gap is the highest ever in U.S. history. And actually, I also, in the book, look at the Middle East and Iran and Iraq.
Oh, yeah, your book is world-ranging. There's no question about that. It goes around the world and looks at different civilizations going back, going back 1,000 years. It's fascinating in that regard. If I can,
right. So the Middle East is also relevant in the context of this coming revolution, because you need three preconditions for a successful revolution. Three prerequisites are needed for the ordinary public's revolt to succeed. One is official corruption. Rising official corruption, which is plenty there right now. The other is increasing poverty, and that's also happening now. The third is an unpopular war, and we have that also. So these are the three preconditions for a successful revolution, and that's why I think we will have a revolution in the next. It has already started. The rise of President Obama. Rise of Obama and his becoming a president is the start of this revolution. But, nobody gives up power so easily, so the...
No, they don't. It's an interesting point because two things. Yesterday on the Internet, I'm looking and I'm seeing... Remember, I'm sure Arthur Laffler, the author of the so-called Laffler Curve. And I think that's the theory from which... Or his curve is a graphic which is used to support... so-called supply-side economics or trickle-down theory. Anyway, he's being interviewed, and he's telling how the President-elect Obama economic transition team are losers, including Warren Buffett, and that they're going to tax us to death. Now, you write in your book, people in power, the elites in power today, are not going to surrender their power easily. They're going to fight. And one of the things I'm certain that's going to happen is it's true, you're going to have intellectual support for this cycle. They're going to rise up and fight for their theories to still be dominant when they see them threatened. I'm just thinking when Arthur Laffler is speaking, and I haven't heard from him in the popular medium for years, when now all of a sudden he's seen in the popular media, if that's a sign that the ruling elites and this current system of economic government feels threatened.
Oh, yeah, that's right. In fact, just look at what the Republicans, especially their talk radio, did when Obama was in the middle of the primary fight. They were afraid of him even at that time. They would ask the Republicans to go vote for Hillary so that she would be the nominee, not Obama. So they were threatened at that time, and Obama has trounced them many times. First, he got the nomination. And then now he has won in a landslide. So they have been feeling, they have felt threatened for a long time, and they will not give up power easily. So I think we are in for a major fight at the intellectual level, especially against these inquisitors and their hirelings. Arthur Laffer is just justifying the rule of the inquisitive class But they will lose. The time is not on their side. If you look at this law of social cycles, according to that cycle, the time is now on the side of the revolution, of the change. And we can see that happening already. But much bigger changes are yet to come. Obama's getting elected is just a start.
You're listening to KRUU, and this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. Our guest host today is local attorney Paul Gandy, and our guest is Dr. Ravi Batra, author of The New Golden Age, The Coming Revolution Against Political Corruption and Economic Chaos. Dr. Batra, can this revolution be peaceful?
Oh, yes, it has been peaceful, even though there has been a lot of darts thrown at Obama. He's a Muslim, he's an Arab, he's a Marxist, socialist, leftist and all that. All these darts have been thrown at him, but...
He wants to share the wealth.
He has attempted at his life yet. So it was a peaceful revolution, and that's the beauty of the current stage of evolution in society, that at least in the Western world, change can occur peacefully, and that's a great thing to have.
Can you give us some examples in history of countries that were at this stage and a revolution occurred and what the result was?
Well, the most recent example of the end of the rule of the wealthy was Cuba. Mm. In Cuba, the military might... a military hero, I guess, or a military commander overthrew the rule of the landlords. The landlords controlled everything in society, and so they had some kind of feudalism. And that was a success. That feudalism was overthrown. The rule of wealth means not just money all the time. Any kind of control over wealth brings you power. That's the rule of the wealthy. Another example of a successful revolution against the rule of wealth was in China. Mao Zedong overthrew feudalism in China. If we look at China, we would say, okay, the king is ruling. But the question is, who was the real power behind the king? Where did he get his money from? Who supported him? And those were the feudal landlords. So China is another example where the rule of the wealthy ended up in a revolution.
Now, in both of those examples, communism followed the rule of the wealthy. Is that what you're predicting?
No. See, China and Cuba essentially have lagged behind in the law of social cycle. The democratic institutions never developed there in the past, but in the United States, democracy is very strong and thriving. And wherever democracy is strong, you are going to have a peaceful revolution. The warriors will take over this time, but remember, I'm talking about a warrior mentality, a warrior mind. Warrior mind does not necessarily mean that the military class is going to rule. The warrior mentality is one in which the person has a lot of courage to oppose injustices, to oppose the establishment. I would say Barack Obama is a warrior because...
Thank you for answering the question I had. You speak in your book of four social classes, and warrior, of course, is one of them. I believe inquisitor is another. Could you talk a little bit more perhaps about President-elect Obama and why you see him as a warrior, and secondly, maybe a little bit just further description about the four different classes?
Well, see, the main feature of a warrior mind is courage. It takes anybody who has a lot of courage is a warrior. Now, you will see that very few intellectuals are happy to go to war, or very few intellectuals are there. Some of them are there, but very few would risk their lives to oppose injustices and risk their families and so on. But somebody who does that has that courage mentality, has warrior in him, and that's why it's not your profession or your occupation that determines what class a person belongs to. Like suppose somebody is in the military but is a great intellectual, then he belongs to the class of intellectuals. He writes well, gives good speeches, has great grasp over issues, etc., then he is an intellectual. So there are four classes in society: the warrior those with warrior mentality, the intellectual mentality, the acquisitive mentality, and then finally the class of physical laborers. So we normally belong to one of these classes, and this way the social cycle evolves in terms of the one of these are dominant in society, except for the physical laborer. The physical laborer is never dominant in society, but a time comes when the physical laborer helps a lot in overthrowing the rule of money.
And your thesis is we are headed toward that? We're in that time or headed toward that time, near that time?
We are in that time right now. I think the revolution has already started, and it will take perhaps another 7 years before it's complete, but I think we can finish it in 2-3 years if we follow the right kind of economic policies. We can shorten the period of economic chaos. Then somebody has to pay attention to what I've written in the last chapter of the book. The final chapter of the book deals with economic reforms, and that's what, like for instance, GM. They're talking about a bailout of GM and spending about another $50 billion to bail out the auto industry. A very simple way would be let the government buy up 60% of the shares in these companies. Like the General Motors, to buy up 60% of General Motors at today's prices would be about $1.5 billion. Then you give this stock to the workers of General Motors. Then these workers call a shareholder meeting. They appoint their own board of directors. They appoint their own CEO. And then it's up to them now what kind of efficient cars they want to make, which they can sell. You don't need $50 billion bailout. You might need to take care of their old pensions and health care. That would be maybe another $15-20 billion at the most. You don't need $50 billion. At the same time, the workers will be very responsible. They would then know it is their job or else. So they will work very hard, produce cars which the market wants to buy. They will not be running after all these SUVs and inefficient cars so that their profits are.
Now, Doctor, you realize that one of the phrases that was jumped on by the opposition Republican Party in the last days, last week's election, was the phrase, share the wealth. And you mentioned in your book, you write in your book, that one of the fears of the acquisitor class is of a centralized government, one, and the concept, the actuality of sharing the wealth. They use that phrase to try to convince, I think, all the groups of people in this country that is something to be afraid of, that somehow most people are going to, it's going to be to most people's detriment, when I think what's behind it is it's designed, not sharing the wealth, to support the current ruling group.
That's exactly right. I mean, why did you mention share the wealth? What they're doing is they are looting the country and concentrating wealth in their own hand. So it's not, people don't have to, I mean, they are the ones who are preying upon the world and taking as much wealth as they can. Somebody has $50 billion in their bank account, somebody has $20 billion. I mean, this is insanity. In the process, they're creating a lot of poverty. What they want to do is just to maintain their status quo, keep the people working off doing their work at very low wages, and so they keep earning money. But that is not even possible in the long run, and that long run is right now here. Wages are the main source of demand, and productivity is the main source of supply. If productivity is rising and wages are not, then there will be a gap between supply and demand. Supply would be larger than demand. Now, to fill this gap up, to maintain the balance between supply and demand, what the various administrations have been doing is this. They have been creating new and new debt, because debt also creates demand. But it's not a lasting solution. It simply postpones the problem and makes it larger. The problem builds up over time. So that's why we find that the U.S. government is in huge debt. People are in a very high level of debt. And the problem has been building up for the past 30 years. And that's why it is not going to be that easy to fix it now.
This is what when you refer to this book. Now, your book was written, your research for your book was done in 2006, or completed in 2006, published in early 2007. But in your book, you talk about the coming housing bubble. And here we are, I think, we're right in the middle of it. I don't know, some people say we're two or three innings in, some people say we're four or five innings in, some people say we're almost done, but we're definitely in some sort of housing bubble. Is this an example of what you mean by this creating this demand, this artificial demand by expanding debt, both in the individual level and the national level?
What did Greenspan do? We have not talked about my other book, Greenspan's Fraud. That's why I wrote the book Greenspan's Fraud in 2005 when he was the chairman of the Federal Reserve. And I took so much flack from my colleagues, from economists. They were all saying, what are you saying? Greenspan is a fraud? And I said, yes, he is fraud. Look what he's doing. He wants to create more and more debt so that there are jobs in society. But these are borrowed jobs. These are borrowed from the future. He is going to wreck the economy in the process. And what was he saying? He used to tell people, go use up your home equity and borrow money. He used to tell the banks, go keep lending money. We need to create jobs. This is the way to do it. And so that's what they have been doing. The reason is the rising wage gap. As the wage gap rises, supply rises faster than demand. So the only remedy left, if you don't want to raise wages, then the only other remedy is to create new debt. That's what the governments have been doing for the past 30 years. By now, the problem is humongous, so huge that it's not going to be easy to fix it. Ben Bernanke and company want to create even more debt in society. I don't understand what school of thought they live in, because they're doing the thing that caused the problem to begin with.
Let's expand this globally, if you can, for a moment, Doctor. So make sure people who are listening understand why it's so important, what your words are. The weight of your words. In your book, you talk about you're speaking before a group of naval officers, I believe, in the early 1990s, and one of them, I believe, as I understand from your book, asked you what you saw in the early 1990s was the greatest foreign threat to the United States. And then, more than 10 years ago, you said radical Islamic fundamentalism. You didn't point to any particular country, but radical Islamic fundamentalism. Now, yesterday, in the USA Today, the current director of the CIA, Michael Hayden, Air Force General, he said the greatest foreign threat to the United States today is Al-Qaeda. The reason it's important to listen to you is that you're saying things 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 3 years ago, that we're seeing in the media spoken by our leaders today. And we want to know. And that's important, I think. Your book is important to read because it gives you some idea of where we're headed. And there's hope. There's hope. But right now, from what you're saying, there's a little rocky road we have to follow.
That's right. I use the law of social cycles to see what was happening around the world, and it appeared to me that radical Islam was a threat not just to the United States but the whole world. But the United States in particular, because the U.S. had been involved in that Iranian revolution. They had held some hostages from the United States. So I felt that the United States had something coming against it. Some radical Islamic fundamentalists would try to blow up the United States, and that's what I mentioned in that lecture. I think it was in Virginia somewhere, Norfolk, Virginia. Yeah.
Now, in your book, you also talk about how you, if I can borrow the analogy of the phrase Waterloo, I guess Waterloo was Napoleon's Waterloo, if you will. But you mentioned, if I understand you correctly, Afghanistan was the Soviet Union's Waterloo because the events that followed thereafter led to its downfall. Is that correct?
That's right. See, I mentioned earlier that there are three preconditions for a revolution in society, for the fall of the system. One is official corruption, rising poverty, and the third is unpopular war. And I had the Afghanistan example in mind when I wrote this. And Soviet Union is no more now, and they had corruption, poverty, and an unpopular war, and that's exactly what we are facing now.
Now, in that book you were writing, in the book you're talking about the fall of a system of government, communism. You also have a book that describes the fall of communism and capitalism. So are you saying that we're in a stage in the social cycle which will lead to a change in our system of government? Actually a fall of this system of capitalism?
Yes, we will see an end to what I call monopoly capitalism. There are two types of capitalism, free market capitalism and monopoly capitalism. What we have now is monopoly capitalism, and we have had it for at least 30 years now. This monopoly capitalism has been flourishing, and this will end. But free market capitalism will prevail and lead to this new golden age that I'm talking about.
What is the main distinction between monopoly capitalism and free market capitalism?
In monopoly capitalism, some very small groups, first of all, industries, the companies are very large. They are so large that their CEOs are very rich, and those rich CEOs can corrupt the political system. They can corrupt the political officials. And those political officials then pass laws favoring the CEOs and so on. So the merger mania is the clear-cut symptom, clear-cut feature of monopoly capitalism. And you know, the irony is that all these companies were merging with other companies in the 80s and the 90s, like ExxonMobil, Exxon bought out Mobil and so on. And these companies are merging with each other, and they became very large, became big. Now they're saying that some of these companies are too big to fail. That's the irony part. They allowed these companies to become so big. Now they're saying these are too big to fail, like AIG. They wouldn't allow it to fail, and so on.
Right.
That is an example of monopoly capitalism gone amok. And free market capitalism is one where the companies are smaller than what they are now. There are many small companies in any industry, like in oil industry. One reform that I have recommended to bring down the price of oil and keep it there at that level, low level, is to break up the oil monopolies. There are regional monopolies in oil. They conspired to raise the price of oil through their production cuts and speculation. And so if we were to break up some of these companies into smaller firms, we will be creating competition in that industry, and that is free market capitalism. Capitalism with a lot of competition among companies is free market capitalism.
Are there any examples of a well-functioning free market capitalist society or country in the world today?
There was a very good example in Japan, for instance. This is how Japan rose to become the second largest economy in a matter of 20 years. In the 1950s, the United States had only four major companies in the auto industry, or three maybe, GM, Chrysler, and Ford, and there was another one, American Motors, a small company. We had four of them. And so we had regional monopolies in the auto sector. In Japan, for a much smaller economy, they had 10 companies, 10 auto industry companies, Toyota, Nissan, Honda, and so on. And see what happens. Because of that internal competition, they become very efficient. And these companies eventually bested our companies, and now they dominate the world auto industry. So that was an example of free market capitalism in the past. But then they followed bad economic policies which they learned from the Harvard School and so on, and then they are in trouble also now. But if they had kept doing what they were doing in the 50s and 60s, they wouldn't be in this problem right now.
President-elect Obama was able to raise unprecedented amounts of money, really in small donations, over the Internet. And so as a result, I think you can make the argument that he's not beholden to the large money interest that typically a candidate running for that level of office would be. Does that give him more freedom, or will he have more freedom in this tumult we're going to experience, according to your theories, over the next several years? And can you give us some idea? We just have a few minutes now. Can you give us some idea what we can expect to have happen over the next 2 to 5 years?
Obama is a genius in terms of political organization and hard work, and he's a great orator and writer at the same time. So he has a lot of great qualities. Unfortunately, in the next 2 years, I think he's going to surround himself with Clintonites. He wanted change, but change will not come if you surround yourself with old political guards. So I think his first year could be a failure. Then he would, I think, learn and then invite new blood into his system. Economy would then improve. But I think until then, we are not going to see much improvement in the economy.
So over the next year, are things going to get worse, stabilize, or how do you see
things? They will get worse and then stabilize in 2010. And that, of course, will happen only if he invites new blood and uses and offers new ideas and genuine economic reform follows. Then I think will happen, but I think that will happen by 2010, because that year the Democrats would be facing elections, and then they would look for new ideas.
What are some of the new ideas and new types of economic reform that you suggest that the ruling party should be looking at even now if they could?
Well, one thing I already suggested was the government could buy up shares of General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler, sell these shares to the workers of the companies, and then let the workers manage their own companies. That will be much cheaper and also will go a long way in improving the soundness of the auto industry. That's one thing they can do. The other thing that they could do is to raise the minimum wage, let's say, $1 a year at a time. The real reason why we have this problem is the huge gap between the productivity and wages, and so there's not much consumer demand in the economy. If you start raising the minimum wage, then the wage rate will catch up with productivity and consumer demand will rise. That's the other thing they can do. These are the two main things that they need to do. Of course, the government can directly create jobs also, but these are the two main ideas to really zero in on and have a long-term solution for the economy.
What about taxes?
Taxes, we can, once the economy recovers, then you raise the income tax rates and cut the Social Security tax slightly. Those things can be done after the economy recovers. But until then, I think we should not create too much social turmoil, because whenever you talk about changing the tax rates, there's a lot of controversy and turmoil.
But you see in the next 2 to 3 years, next 1 to 2 years, you see a change. We're going to maybe bottom out in the next year or so, and things are going to start turning around, going to be turning around, because the Democrats in power are going to want to stay in power, so they're going to be willing to try new ideas, but it won't be maybe until 2010.
That's right. See, until then, they will try all these ideas of free trade and bailing out banks, cutting taxes, and so on. Free trade is the biggest culprit right now in creating our poverty, and we can't get out of it. So either we create a balanced free trade, which is another reform I've recommended. We should have a balanced free trade. That is, okay, you want free trade, fine, but don't have trade deficit at the same time.
And you suggested perhaps a two-tiered exchange system might be
which useful. Unfortunately, we don't have time to get into right now, because we're bumping up against the top of the hour. We've been speaking today on Writer's Voices with Dr. Ravi Batra, the author of The New Golden Age, The Coming Revolution Against Political Corruption and Economic Chaos. And Dr. Batra, I'm really was very pleased to have you here. This was a very informative conversation. We could go on for another hour, I'm sure.
Maybe be available some other time in the future to talk again about this book or another.
Yeah, just call me back. Write me back on my email. We can even talk about Greenspan's fraud, all the things he did.
I think that would be very, very beneficial. But the one thing I want to leave our listeners with, two things. One is, for more information, you can go to Dr. Batra's website, which is ravibatra.com. And also that although he talks about going through some hard times, he definitely sees a light at the end of the tunnel.
The new golden age.
The new golden age. And that's it this week for Writers' Voices, and look forward to joining you next week.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thanks a lot.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.